Coming up,
the 11th century royal toilet that's helped reveal one of the mysteries of the Bayeux Tapestry.
It's a bit of a paradox that you locate a royal site based on a loo.
Danny Wooten is here for this month's Time Team News.
And Meg Russell's out and about. Hi, Meg, looking at the science behind the well-being benefits of archaeology.
It's all on this episode of the Time Team podcast.
Yes, hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Dr. Helen Geig, where we unearth the world of archaeology. And it's a big episode of the podcast because for the first time ever, you can watch us on the Time Team official YouTube channel. We have hit the big time, Helen. So welcome if this is your first time that you're with us. We do this fairly regularly. There are plenty of old episodes to listen to wherever you get your podcasts. Helen is, of course, an archaeologist, you'll know from many Time Team digs. And I'm new to the world of archaeology, but I'm really enjoying learning all about it.
I think you're doing very well, Martin. You're a quick learner and you've been learning from the best as well, haven't you?
If you say so yourself, yeah.
Well, I don't think I've taught you as much as perhaps some of the others. Yeah. We had a huge reaction to our previous episode, all about the women of Iron Age Britain. We featured Dr. Rachel Pope from the University of Liverpool, and she talked about the new research that's shedding light on the different roles that women played in different cultures across Britain. And we caught up with our old Time Team friends, Bridget Gallagher and Raisanne Alcabasi in New Zealand, to reminisce about our Channel 4 days.
Yeah, it was a fairly decent episode, wasn't it? And one of our Patreon members agrees here. This is Martin Young, who says, "This was the first podcast I've ever listened to, and what an inspirational introduction to the format it has been for me. I'm a convert. My entire Sunday will now be dedicated to listening to the previous episodes." Oh, Martin, thank you.
That is so lovely. Thank you, Martin, for your kind words. And yes, this episode is another great one. Danny's waiting in the wings to bring you this month's Time Team News. Hi, Danny. But first of all, I'd like to talk about a toilet.
What?
Yes, and this isn't just any toilet. It's a royal toilet. Or perhaps, as it's so posh, I should call it a lavatory. Now, it's linked to the Bayeux Tapestry and it has led to an amazing discovery.
Okay, so you're saying this is a royal toilet. So who did it belong to?
It belonged to King Harold. Now, he's the last Anglo-Saxon king of England. So, of course, he's depicted on the Bayeux Tapestry, which tells the story of the Norman conquest of England and the Battle of Hastings in 1066. Now, if you look at the Bayeux Tapestry, you might notice King Harold's residence. It crops up twice, but researchers have always struggled to conclusively work out where that residence actually was until now, and it's all thanks to his loo.
Okay, well, let's find out more by speaking to Duncan Wright, senior lecturer in medieval archaeology at Newcastle University, who's been involved in the research. Duncan, great to have you on. Where is this residence then?
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to chat to you. The residence is at Bosham, as we kind of knew from the tapestry, as Helen's said, but its exact location wasn't known until our work. And it's kind of where local folklore had it, but our work, I think, has demonstrated it with some certainty.
So how big a part then did the toilet play in finding the site?
Well, the toilet is actually the crucial piece of information, and it's a bit of a paradox that you locate a royal site based on a loo, but that's certainly what we've got here. The site was actually excavated in 2006. We didn't really know the significance of the find of a cesspit that was made in the garden of this large house, but we now know that cesspit is attached to a timber building. And the last 10, 15 years or so, it's become pretty clear that integrated toilets, en suites, if you will, are very much a distinctive feature of late Saxon, very high status buildings. And so that helped us push, the occupation of the site, not just before the conquest, but also locate its, you know, definitive high status nature.
I'm really rather behind on how the archaeology of the lavatory has developed over the last, I don't know, couple of decades.
Don't say you're behind when you're talking about a lavatory.
There's too many puns.
So why would a high-status palace, say, have an inside loo when that would make it smell terrible?
Well, they're actually appended to one end of the building, which is a key facet, and they're very much for private use. So they're at the chamber end of a building, so they're very much an ensuite. They're appended to somebody's bedroom, in effect, really. So even within the hall, not everyone gets access to the lavatory. So it's very distinctive, and we do see that at Bosham, which is really key.
So how were we unable to prove where this residence was? Because this must be a pretty important residence that we would want to know about, and it would have been very important at the time. How is it that we were unable to prove where it was until now?
I think central to this is that archaeologists haven't really looked in earnest. A big question around Bosham is why did William not build a castle there? He retains it as a royal property, the only one in Sussex that he does, but he doesn't build a castle. And I think if he had, archaeologists would have studied it to death. You know, we'd know an awful lot about Bosham. So partly we haven't really looked, and we haven't looked properly. I think that's the answer.
The first picture of Bosham, I'm just looking at it now, and in the bare tapestry, I've got my book open. It is a very peculiar building. I mean, they're all upstairs. I mean, Martin will know my obsession with upstairs in all sorts of times.
You need to sort this out. You've got a problem with needing to know whether stairs existed or not.
The stairs are very clear. Mm. The stairs are very clear. But there's very little detail on what the downstairs was used for. And of course, a loo has to have, as you say, Duncan, a cesspit. So they're very obvious in the archaeological record, aren't they? And they're also often, because the things that you drop down the cesspit, down the loo, you don't tend to want to get back, or you don't try very hard. So they're amazing traps of finds, and they usually have wonderful dating and cultural evidence in them.
Absolutely. I suppose the caveat to that is that somebody has to empty it, so some poor soul has to go in and, you know, episodically get involved. But as you say, they do tend to leave remarkable finds behind. The issue of the first floor hall or not is a long running debate in early medieval archaeology. But it does look a very unusual building, and I think the fact that it's right at the start of the tapestry, just after a scene from London, really emphasises the primacy of its status in Harold's life. This is clearly his key family site, and it was his seat of his father before that. Yeah, it really is very important. And it's probably Bosham again that is shown later. When Harold returns from Normandy later in the tapestry, there's a enigmatic building, a tower with people looking out to sea, looking for him to return. It's probably at Bosham as well, but unfortunately that's one site we didn't find.
One of the things we ought to remind listeners about is that if they want to see the Bayeux tapestry, then they're going to have to hurry up, because the museum's undergoing a big refit, and all of this is going to take about, well, at least 2 years. So you've got to see it before the end of August this year, or you're going to have to wait.
And Duncan, how many more toilets and various things like that kind of appear on the tapestry? Because we don't actually get to see the toilet that allowed you to find this residence doesn't actually appear on the tapestry, but there are far more ruder things that do.
There are. There's lots. Well, there's naked people. There's, yeah, sexual parts. There's all sorts. It gets very racy. And the fact this is probably made by nuns makes it even more interesting for that reason, I think. So, but no, sadly, the toilet itself doesn't appear. But what the tapestry does show at Bosham that's really important is that duality of a church and a residence. These power centres are very much characterised by those two components.
Yes, there's an awful lot of feasting shown, and not anything at all of the other end.
Yeah, it's a shame. It doesn't show the full process, yeah.
Is it a shame? I think it's probably just fine as it is. Duncan, really, really interesting, and congratulations on finally being able to prove what was long known as to where King Harold did what he had to do.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
This is the Time Team podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Time Team. If you're watching us or hearing us for the first time and you want more, then make sure you hit follow on your podcast app so you never miss an episode.
If you support us on Patreon, then you'll already know you get access to loads of extra stuff from Time Team. And when it comes to the podcast, we bring you extended versions of the interviews that we do. So on Patreon right now is the full conversation with Duncan that you've just heard, as well as chats with Dr. Rachel Pope and Bridget Gallagher from our last episode, plus Dr. Sophie Hay on those new excavations at Pompeii.
Yep, head over there if you want even more from Time Team and to support archaeology happening here in the UK and around the world. Speaking of which, it's time for this month's Time Team news. And here's Danny. Hello, Danny.
Hi, Helen. Hi, Martin. How are you doing?
Very, very well, thank you. I'm very interested to know a little bit more about some of the amazing discoveries that have been made right around the world.
It's fantastic, isn't it? There's always something to be discovered. That's the wonderful thing with archaeology. Well, firstly, we are going to head to the City of London. Lots of us work in offices these days. Now, just imagine if you are working in an office and they discover a Roman basilica literally underneath the concrete floor that you're working in. Well, this is exactly what happened here in the City of London. So archaeologists from the Museum of London Archaeology put in a series of test pits in an office space. And they literally put a test pit down in between filing cabinets. And not only did they discover the basilica, but they actually came down onto the kind of platform area where all the officials would have actually sat while they were going about their official duties. And I think it was likened by one of the representatives of MOLA, said it's a bit like coming down on the speaker's chair in the House of Commons. Like, what are the chances of that?
Just incredible. I love the idea of them putting these test pits in between the filing cabinets. I mean, imagine if that was in an office that you worked in and they're just doing archaeology right under your feet amongst all the office furniture and everything. I think that's just amazing. Tell me a little bit more then about this basilica. How important would that building have been in Roman Britain?
Well, the basilica is part of kind of a complex, really, of the Roman Forum. Many people will be aware of the Roman Forum in Rome, that really famous, amazing archaeological site. But this basilica, which is basically like a town hall, this was kind of the most important building. This is where all the administration happened for Londinium, for London.
The thing that I would like to know next, though, is what happened when that basilica was abandoned? How did it fall down? Why didn't it turn into a church? Because so many of them did. This is, as I understand it, about halfway between St. Paul's in the west and the Tower of London in the east. So it is, as you say, dead in the heart of Roman London. How did it fall down? Why did it fall down? What was going on when it did? How was it seen by people at the end of the Roman Empire? How did it contribute to the development of London as a whole, as the capital has always stayed the capital of an Anglo-Saxon kingdom and then the capital of England? How did it affect the development of that right up to the present day? How did it become lost, I suppose, is what I want to know.
Yes, absolutely. And now we're going from London all the way to ancient Egypt, where archaeologists believe that they've discovered the tomb of Pharaoh Thutmose II. This was excavated a few years ago, and it's taken a while to actually do all the post-excavation research. So it's recently been announced that they now believe that this is the tomb of Thutmose II, which is the last missing tomb of the 18th dynasty.
Right. So how did they know that it was that particular pharaoh rather than any of the others?
This is the kind of crux. This is the exciting bit, really, because...
Because he wasn't in there, was he?
No, this is the thing. So he'd been moved. So the tomb itself was placed behind a waterfall. So it got very, very damp. And over the years, they think probably quite soon after Thutmose II was interred there, that the body was moved, is the idea. This is what they think. And they were trying to figure out, well, whose tomb is it? But when they discovered blue ceilings and yellow stars, they thought, well, this is the kind of decor, really, that's very much associated with with kings. They painstakingly went through all the kind of detritus and things that they found in the tomb and recovered some broken fragments of alabaster vases. And on these inscriptions, they discovered two inscriptions that really helped them to identify this. One, it was Tut, T-H-U-T, that they found, or the equivalent of. So they're like, okay, it's at Tutmosis. It's either the first or the second, but how on earth are we going to discover this? So they're narrowing it down. And then the second fragment actually contained the words or the name of Hatshepsut, who is the wife of Tutmosis II. So it had to be Tutmosis II's tomb.
So if Tutmosis II isn't actually in that tomb, though, where is he buried? Is there another one to find?
Possibly. I think some Egyptologists believe that they have the body of Tutmosis II in the National Museum of Egyptian Civilization, but I believe that some Egyptologists think that's not Tutmosis II, and that possibly because he was moved from one tomb, possibly due to flooding, also possibly due to rival dynasties, that they moved the body from the first tomb and put him in a second one. And they believe that potentially they found a second tomb, and it's just possible that Tutmosis II might still be in that tomb.
Every time something exciting is found in Egypt, people tend to say, well, this is the last one. You know, there's possibly or probably nothing else there to be found. And then something else gets found. It's the gift that keeps on giving, isn't it? Even though people have been trying to find these things for hundreds of years now.
Yes, absolutely. It's definitely one to keep our eye on. Now, for our final piece of Time Team news this month, I'm going to take you all the way to America and the discovery of a British fort there in the oldest city in America, St. Augustine in Florida. This is the longest inhabited city in America, and it was first claimed by the Spanish in 1565, although obviously there would have been people living there beforehand as well. This has changed hands from the Spanish to the British hands in the 18th century, and they've discovered a fort there. Archaeologists knew that there had been seven forts in the area, in St. Augustine, in that area previously. It's on maps, it's documented, but they don't know exactly where. So what they did is they had the opportunity, whilst the land was being cleared for development, to actually discover, to actually see what was there in the area. The Florida Public Archaeology Network got involved and they did some ground penetrating radar and discovered a series of long diagonal lines, which they think are part of this fort. So you'd pile up an earthwork and build a ditch as well. And I think what's happened is the rampart, the raised part, the mound, has eventually kind of fallen itself in back into the ditch kind of thing. And you're left with this kind of staining in the soil. So that's what they think they've found. I think it dates, the construction of the forts, I think, date to about 1781. So this is pretty old archaeology, isn't it?
Yeah, it's right in around the moment of the Revolutionary Wars and Wars of Independence and so on and so forth. I have to say, I'm speaking as a British person here with extremely poor knowledge of United States history, so I have to apologise to everybody listening if I've got all those names completely wrong. I've got to brush up on it, because what staggered me about that, Danny, though, is that if the Spanish are first building this city in 1565, that is 20 years before Roanoke, and it's 40 years before Jamestown. I have got used to thinking of those as staggeringly early, and this is decades before that. It just shows you how fast some of that colonisation was, that no sooner had Europe worked out what was going on in the Americas than we were all over it like a bad cold.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Danny, for coming and telling us about those stories from right across the globe. It's been a real window into a few different worlds there.
You're very welcome, Helen. Speak to you soon.
Yep, lovely. Thank you.
I'm just looking here at some of the latest videos from Time Team on YouTube at the moment, and our excavation into the mystery mounds at Poverty Point in Louisiana in the US is up now. It's a really, really great watch if you haven't seen it already. It features Time Team's geophysics expert, Jimmy Adcock, who Helen and I actually recorded an interview with the other day. So we're going to be putting that out on a coming episode of the podcast. Right now, Time Team archaeologist Meg Russell is here now. Hi, Meg.
Hi, Martin. Hi, Helen.
Hello, hello. Now, we've got Meg on to talk about something that we're trying to discuss a little bit more, but it's something that us archaeologists have known kind of instinctively for ages. It's the benefits that doing archaeology can bring to your mental health and your well-being.
Yeah, and we're hoping that we can bring some of those health and well-being benefits to you by explaining how and why being out in a landscape, unearthing history, can actually help you.
And Meg, you're somewhere that's trying to put that anecdotal evidence and that real hard evidence into practice, aren't you? Where are you?
Yes, exactly right, Helen. So I am just outside Bournemouth University, and I am in an area which is called Talbot Woods. And we come out to these woods quite a lot to do foraging as part of the sanctuary project, which we spoke about the other month. And what we do is we come out and see what natural resources are in these woods. So last month we were foraging for gauze to make some nice yellow dye. This month it is a month for nettles to be coming up, so we might be collecting some nettles for cordage, and also some wild garlic, hopefully. That is just beautiful in lots of different ancient cooking recipes. So yeah, this is one of the woods that we come to, and it's really, really great because a lot of our work is focused on campus, on proving that ancient craft and archaeology can be portable, but it is also important to come out into nature. So we're very lucky to have this space.
And I think you're not too far away, Meg, there from a, I was going to call it a building, but I suppose it's a structure of sorts that is very close to your heart, which is a place called The Sanctuary. Can you just explain a little bit about that and how it works?
As you said, we're very, very close to the Sanctuary Hub, I suppose, which is a polytunnel. And that's where we focus a lot of our... Can you hear that woodpecker? Sorry, just heard a lovely woodpecker then. And that's where we keep all of our resources, where we do a lot of our growing from scratch, a lot of our herbs from scratch. And it creates a little centre, really, for the local community to come onto campus to do different ancient craft and experimental archaeology.
And what research have you been doing to back up this anecdotal knowledge that we've always had, that archaeology is really healing and restorative and good for your well-being?
If you don't mind, what I'm going to do is I'll go back, really, I suppose, to what my work has been based on that other people have done. It comes down to the five ways to well-being. It was first published by Aked et al. In 2008. It's now recommended by the NHS. What I'm going to do is I'll break it down. It's really easy to remember. It's just clang.
Clang.
Clang. So connect with other people. It's really important to make sure that even if it's not necessarily in big groups with a lot of people, it's really important to be reaching out to your community and sharing. You have L, which is learning new skills. We're always learning new skills from lots of different people, whether that's excavation or ancient craft. There's being physically active. And again, that does not mean necessarily digging holes every day. It's moving your body and getting that benefit of endorphins of moving. It's taking notice. So like we just did with recognizing that bird song, it's really making sure that you take time to be in the present, because we're so busy a lot of the time to not take notice. Sometimes when I film outside, I don't even notice that bird song. And then it's not until I watch the footage back that I go, oh, that was really beautiful, but I was in my own head. And then there's G, which is giving, or giving to other people. And that's a really important thing that I think isn't as easy to remember, just because we don't always know how to have that in our daily lives. So sometimes that is making a cup of tea for somebody, or saying, should we have a break, and having a break together. That can be giving. This clang, this five ways to well-being, has been adapted by many other people looking at how archaeology can be good for well-being. So projects like Human Henge, which was here in Dorset, and also Operation Nightingale, Waterloo Uncovered, Wings to the Past. Everybody uses this in a different sense, really, and that's the foundation for how to bring well-being into your life. but I think you can really see how it's easily adaptable to archaeology. It's also this element of, which is kind of inside the five ways to well-being, which is purpose and value. And a lot of archaeology well-being research has been looking into how archaeology specifically does this, because through excavation, through ancient craft, experimental archaeology, you're adding to that archaeological understanding and the archaeological record. So you have that value and purpose. My research, additionally, also goes into a little bit of neuroscience, because it brings in this idea of somatic empathy. So really, when I say that, we know what empathy means. It's understanding other people, putting yourself into their shoes. But sometimes people find that really, really hard to do. And there's a few researchers, Cooper, Engel, they're looking at how through doing something with the body and mimicking that activity next to somebody else, your body is understanding the way that they move. And that can actually help you to then understand how other people think, how they feel, and connect to them. So whether that is digging side by side with somebody or doing an ancient craft activity next to them, you're starting to understand them better. And that, as well as something that's been published very recently by Martins in the Exarch Journal, is artifactual movement. And that's the idea that in the last few thousand years, our anatomy hasn't changed. And so the way we hit a nail with a hammer is exactly the same way that somebody in the past would have done that. And so not only can we understand our contemporary crafters or archaeologists, we can understand the people in the past through moving in the same way.
There's just so much science behind it. And I just think it's so interesting, because it's something that people feel. You know, you guys, anecdotally, you know, you tell me, we feel this when we're out and about, we're in a trench, whatever. But actually, there's so much science to say, yeah, you know, you're right, there is science behind it. Really, really interesting. And Meg, thank you for taking us on your walk with us as well, because we felt some of the benefits of being outside without even having to go. So that's fantastic. Thank you. And we'll leave you to it. We'll leave it to the rest of you. To the rest of your walk.
Yeah, no worries. Maybe I'll catch you guys down here soon.
That would be nice. Yes.
See you, Meg.
All right. See you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Right, questions now, and this is where our Patreon supporters get the opportunity to ask Helen, our resident archaeologist, a question, and nothing is off limits, no matter how silly you might think the question is. Head to Patreon now, patreon.com/timeteamofficial, and ask your question like so many people have. We're getting so many of these messages. I think we're going to have to do another episode that's just dedicated to Patreon messages and questions for Helen so that we can get through some of these. Let's start with this one. It comes from Richard Abbott, who says, growing up, I was fascinated by the layers of occupation at Vindolanda. What is the location that you've dug that's had the most separate overlapping layers of occupation? I think what I first need to understand here is, Helen, what are layers of occupation?
That's what we normally call something like a deeply stratified site. So that's when things are piled on top of each other and intercutting. And you normally find that kind of thing in towns. Rural sites, which Time Team does specialise in, really, because they're something you can get to grips with over just 3 days, they tend to just be one episode that is then protected to a certain extent and eroded to a certain extent by plough soil. So you take off the plough soil, you find what's there, and you look at it, and it appears to be a snapshot in time. Other places, like towns, have always attracted settlement in the same place for centuries or perhaps even millennia. There's a kind of ebb and flow according to how much investment's going into a town, how much you've got a market economy which needs a town there, where people are choosing to live because of their lifestyle and their society. And I think for me, because I'm really much more of a rural archaeologist than an urban archaeologist, so I haven't done an awful lot of work in towns, but I did spend some time digging in Winchester when I was a student, and that's a classic example. So it's founded by the Romans, and then there's a bit of a hiatus, and then it's designed by King Alfred and the Anglo-Saxons. Then it has a medieval town coming in and kind of like a lair on top. But of course, everybody digs holes for lavatories or for rubbish pits or for making tanning works or all sorts of industry. And so you have all these holes dug through it. So it's not a case of necessarily just being like a layer cake. It's really, really complicated. The specialism of urban archaeology is something that's really, really difficult to get your head around, and you really need to be an expert in it. For Time Team, the thing that I think of when you think of a deeply stratified or highly stratified site is actually a site that wasn't in use for that long. It's Dotton Mill. Because of the mill stream, every so often a layer was laid down by the mill stream every time anything happened. I mean, possibly it was literally every year, about 50 layers down. I was digging it with Bridge, and we found a milk bottle top, and we realised that we hadn't got very deep. And when we got to the end of it, and it was so beautiful, all these tiny little layers, we thought the thing that we should do with this place is that we should bring students here, because it is absolutely textbook for how stratigraphy lays down, how natural processes lay down these layers that are naturally laid down, but they're all about human activity. So in just 100 years of Dotton Mill, you had virtually 100 layers of activity. It was the most extraordinary place.
Richard, get yourself to Dotton Mill, I would say, by the sounds of things. Thank you very much for your question. I'm going to have a little sneaky question now. And the reason I'm asking it now is because it relates to the next Patreon question. But it is something that I've been thinking about for quite a while now, actually. And I've always been meaning to ask, and it keeps slipping my mind. Can you explain, what is dendrochronology? We've talked about it before. I think I sort of vaguely understand it, but I think I need a proper explanation. What is it? How can it be used? And how does it help?
Yes, well, dendrochronology, of course, it's a kind of posh Latin name for what you might call in English tree ring dating. And I think we all know that trees have a season of growth every year, and that they lay that down as a ring, so that if you chop down a tree, you can count the rings and discover how old the tree was. And you can build up a sequence to go back hundreds or maybe even 1,000 years. All of this amazing work that can work out when a tree was felled right up to the season, you know, like spring 1425 or something, because if you've got that last ring, you could be just before the bark, the sapwood, you can go right up to the end. All of that couldn't be done until you had all this basic research, which was just data gathering in a sense. These days, people commission a survey of a building first, so they know where the crucial bits are that they need the date, and take many more samples, and it's a much more sophisticated way of dating a structure. It's getting that very, very precise date that is so seductive. You know, you can almost put yourself back into a specific year or a month, and it just brings it all to life so amazingly well. So it's a fantastic technique, dendrochronology.
You can get so much information then from it. It brings me on to Leanne's question. Leanne says this: I worry about the wood coring in dendrochronological research. If you removed a sample from a rafter or whatever it is the hole filled up after the sample's removed? This is an interesting point, isn't it? Because it comes to sort of talking about the damage sometimes that archaeological processes can have on the thing that you're investigating.
Yes, an awful lot of archaeology is destructive. So while you can take another dendrochronological sample, you can't do it ad infinitum. You can't carry on and on and on taking these cores away. So there's always that trade-off between having the date now, taking your sample now, and waiting for perhaps better techniques in the future. But the thing about filling in the holes, it's interesting because generally you have a choice. When you commission a dendrochronological survey, they will ask you if you'd like to have the holes tidied up, if you'd like them to be kind of neatened up with a peg to disguise that hole, or whether you'd like to leave it open. And some people like to leave it open because they like to say, oh, look, and that's where I've had my dendro survey done. I have heard people say, well, it's honest, isn't it? You're not trying to fill it up with a peg, so it might look like an ancient peg hole, and people might mix it up. And then people say, well, you've always got the report to show what's a peg hole and what's not. But it kind of sums up the difference between history, in a way, and archaeology, because the written report is a historical document. So you can lose it. You can lend it to somebody and they never give it back, whatever. But the archaeological, the physical evidence is always there. Perhaps not as detailed because you haven't got the actual answer and the core's been taken away. But it's the physical evidence that you had a dendrochronological survey, that somebody lived there who was interested in this house. That's always going to be there.
So interesting. I think we need to do a lot more, don't we, on dendrochronology at some other point on a future podcast. Thank you for your questions. Brilliant as ever. If you've had something that you've always wanted to know about archaeology or maybe Time Team itself, join our community over on Patreon. We're all very, very friendly. Go to patreon.com/timeteamofficial for all the details. And of course, to get all those extra bits from Time Team as well, including the extended interviews from this very podcast.
That's it from the Time Team podcast for now. Thank you so much for joining us, whether you've been listening or whether you've been watching us on YouTube.
Hit follow wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you get the next episode. Or if you're watching on YouTube, make sure you subscribe to the channel and we'll catch you on the next Time Team podcast.
Take care.
Bye.